All right, welcome back to Overtime for Off the Record with Peter Riddell, who is a noted attorney who sued the state of Michigan, does not like the term that he sued the governor, because I'll tell you what, suing the governor, there's a political risk of that, isn't there, for your business, right?
Oh, there's absolutely a political risk, no doubt about it.
And so did you think about that before you said yes to this lawsuit?
Of course. Yeah, of course I did.
And so you rolled the dice and you got your fingers crossed that she's not angry at you, right?
Huh? Well, you know, I'm sure the governor's people are going to be upset, but I've known the governor a long time, and I know that she understands the need to have an advocate for these student athletes.
All right, Chad, jump in here.
Yeah, Peter, you've been in the town a long time. You have a lot of relationships, and you've been like yourself, like all of us, working from home, trying to sort of triage your work, I imagine, remotely. How do you think the executive office is functioning and the state departments are functioning at the leadership level as far as keeping all of the trains moving while people are still trying to do it from their basements and patios and such?
Well, I think that's a great question, Chad, and I think that's a tough one for me to answer remotely. What I have seen, there's been some great moments, and there's been some incredibly low moments. So, right, you know, the governor's response in March, April, May of 2020 was off the charts remarkable. She was on top of everything. Her team was on top of everything. They were thinking things through. And then, you know, I think she's had some departures in her staff, right? I mean, Susie Scarelli, as an example, got appointed to the Children's Ombudsman and then got into a political fight with the Senate. So I think she's had some staff turnover. And I think that's probably impacting some of their ability today. You also have the national specter and everything that's gone on with Trump and Biden and the threats against the governor's life. So I think she's had a heck of a tough 12 months. And, you know, if you grade it in total, I think they've done a very good job.
Emily.
What's your, as Chad said, you've been in town a long time. What's your assessment of sort of the relationship between the governor and the legislature right now? And does it strike you as a standout in any way as compared to previous executive legislative branch relationships you've seen over the years?
So you're not going to give me a softball at all today, are you, Emily?
That's why we pay her the big bucks, Peter. Go for it.
So you know, I'm gonna be frank and direct here. This is the worst relationship between a legislature and a governor I've seen in my entire time here. So, you know, and you go back to this fork in the road that I would argue would be around April 5th of 2020. When Governor Whitmer decided to double down on the stay-at-home restrictions, and the federal government had already issued CISA 2.0, and the governor, right, said, we're going to stay with CISA 1.0. She took a suggestion by State Representative Jack O'Malley to restrict people from going to their second homes because of the, you know, concern of some of the townies, so to speak, in these northern Michigan communities. And I think that was the fork in the road that caused the relationship with the legislature and the governor to deteriorate in a way that we have not seen an ability to resurrect. I think the governor's state of the state was a great olive branch back towards the legislature, trying to resurrect and recreate a relationship. But I think it takes a little bit more than just a 20-minute speech to do so.
Abigail.
I'm interested. You mentioned the kind of immense and awesome power that people have reawoken to, that governors have during the coronavirus pandemic, and the importance of the legislature having some of a voice to set metrics and make decisions during a situation like a pandemic. But public health officials have really pushed back on that and said that that could put them in a bind to control the spread of the coronavirus. How do you propose, you know, there's a greater share of power in the decision making while still keeping people safe?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a fantastic question, Abigail. So, you know, first and foremost, we are in a once in a century pandemic, right? No one's going to argue with that. So how do you balance the ability of the executive branch, whether it is you know, the state health department or these local health departments to manage outbreaks. And, you know, other states have done it differently, right? But we also have a local system in place. So when we keep alluding to, and this is probably the third time in this kind of segment that we've talked about the local system, right? We can have local orders that don't have the same impact statewide, right? So if we don't have an outbreak in Shepherd, Michigan, right, we don't necessarily need to have the same restrictive orders in Shepherd that we would need to have in East Lansing. So we can have a decentralized approach. And, you know, I think, you know, there has been this balance with the administration, right? On the defensive side, so to speak, on the orders, on the restrictive orders, they have been broad, sweeping, statewide. However, when you look at what I would characterize as our offensive strategy, right, the vaccine management, the vaccine distribution, we've had an incredibly decentralized, right, approach, right? The local health departments are given the, you know, carte blanche of authority on priority groups. We see something different in Detroit than we see in Macomb, than we see in Pontiac. So I think we're trying to balance, the governor and the health director are trying to balance this state control versus local control. I think I've danced all around your question. So feel free to ask a follow-up in this overtime.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, do you think that the legislature should be in a position to set metrics to hand to those local officials, even if we had a more decentralized approach?
Yeah, I think they should, right? I think they should have the ability to set metrics, right? You know, we can argue about what the metrics are, but I think it's well within the legislature's purview to set state policy. And if part of that state policy is setting a metric, that's well within the legislature's purview. And, you know, I don't really argue with their ability to do so. I would argue if a metric is too restrictive and does not provide the flexibility that an executive would need to deal with times of pandemic. But there are all sorts of mechanisms to overcome that. We can sunset it. We can do all sorts of things. We can make it specific to coronavirus. There's all sorts of ways to narrow in the focus, right? I'm going back to something I said earlier, right? This is a once in a century issue, right? But our history is the 1918-1919 pandemic, where we had a statewide order of 21 days. We're going to be over 365 days in statewide orders as a result of the order issued yesterday.
Counselor, let's cut to the chase. Was Robert Gordon part of the problem?
Oh, good question, Tim. Next.
No. All right. I'll rephrase the question, Your Honor. The chatter on the street, the people you hang around with, was there a consensus that he was either asked to leave or would be shown the door and fired? What's your take on the chatter that you hear?
I think Robert Gordon had a bumpy road from day one, right? His confirmation hearing, he was the only gubernatorial appointee that was forced to have two confirmation hearings. I think that he did not necessarily ingratiate himself with people in this town, and I think that helped cause part of his downfall. I don't think he built the relationships in the same way that Elizabeth Hertel has fantastic relationships. So I think it's a multi-factored answer, but I think his ability and his focus potentially on moving to D.C. had a lot of people questioning his dedication and thoughts towards Michigan.
All right, same question, different person. Describe to me what you would describe is the relationship or not between a certain governor and a certain Republican leader in the Senate.
You know, Jason Wentworth and the governor.
His name is Shirky, Mr. Shirky, by the way. This is why you've lasted so long in our town, Peter. Seriously.
So, I think their relationship is frayed. I think we've seen it. We've seen it in print. The problem is because there's two alike, right? They're both very, very smart people. They both have really well-centered moral compasses, and they know exactly where they want to go. The difference is some of those directions are, you know, really quite in conflict. I think, you know, if you look back pre-pandemic, the relationship had ups and downs, but they knew how to communicate with each other in a productive way. And again, I would just go back to my April 5th kind of fork in the road date. I think that's when it deteriorated. And so I think that's been a very difficult thing for both of those individuals to overcome. And I think it's important for the state as we move into these next 2 years that they find a way to be able to communicate again.
Do you see any similarity between the Jennifer Granholm and Mike Bishop problem that we also saw? Same players, same offices, same thing?
You know, I think this one is a little bit different. I think it is the chasm is greater in this particular case. And part of it is a result of the executive power that the governor's been forced to use, chosen to use, however you want to characterize it. Jennifer Granholm never tried to use executive power to the same level that Governor Whitmer has.
Emily, we'll do two more questions and then we'll let the counselor go.
When you
see if you can go for three, Emily.
Okay. Softballs, Emily, softballs.
That is a sport. no. When you were speaking to Abigail's question earlier, it struck me that, you know, we're talking about sort of moving this power from people who are accountable to voters, like the governor and the legislature, to local health officials, which are typically not elected positions, as far as I know. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I mean, is that sort of proper? I mean, would that help take some of the politics out of the air around these decisions?
You know, that's a really good question. I think, and one that I hadn't contemplated until you asked it. But yeah, I think it would, right? I think it would take some of the tension, some of the political tension out of these decisions, right? We are still, you know, I don't think any of us would argue with this, that we're still becoming a more divided country, a more divided state in red and blue. And so we'll see if this redistricting commission that's going to come out is going to help, right, force candidates back to the middle and help lessen that divide. But yeah, the crux of your question is, yeah, I think depoliticizing some of these decisions would be a great idea.
Abigail.
In our previous legal challenges to the governor, when her powers were ultimately winnowed in October, we saw her emergency powers as governor challenged, and specific power granted to her by the legislature previously. We haven't seen as many challenges to the state public health code. Do you think as legal challenges to pandemic restrictions continue that things will center around the public health code, or as in your lawsuit, the director of health and human services?
So, you know, the epidemic orders that are granted to the director of public health, right, in the state law, right, has been transferred in 1996 by John Engler to the director of community health and then eventually health and human services, right, have an intelligible principle associated with them, right? It requires there to be a pandemic first, then it allows that director to issue orders restricting gatherings, and then this, you know, kind of third piece of it, which is the procedures. So it is different in the sense that there is more restrictions, there's more guidance, there's more legislative clarity on the power and the authority of the director of public health. So I don't see that a challenge to that authority directly is one that is going to be successful, and it's not one that is based in our lawsuit at all.
Counselor, thanks for doing our program. One final question. You're going to love this one. Who's been your favorite governor to work with?
Ooh, that's a great question. I would probably go back and say Jennifer Granholm. Right. And part of it was the relationship that I had with many of the people on her staff, you know, starting first and foremost with her chief operating officer.
Who was?
A guy by the name of Rick Weiner, I think.
Yeah, there you go. OK, I almost thought you would say John Engler.
Well, you know, I don't really like those guys from Beale City as a Shepherd guy. There's a little rivalry back there.
Duly noted. You're going to hear from him on that. Counselor, thanks for joining us on Off the Record. Also, our thanks to Chad and Abigail and Emily. A great show, folks. Everybody stay warm this weekend, and we'll see you right back here next week with another edition of Off the Record.